Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From the independent producer project of KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories and personal documentaries. Today on the program, we all know the rags-to-riches story, the Rocky story. Set your goal, believe in yourself, work hard, and the golden ring will be within your grasp. It's an archetype of books, films, and sports. But real life just doesn't usually work that way. The big break happens to someone else, your dream stays a dream, and the movie doesn't end. Today on Unfictional, Cut Your Losses, three stories about falling short and having to move on anyway, as we all do. Beginning with the story of Ariel Beck. She was an amateur MMA fighter, and when the opportunity came to enter her first pro bout, she took it. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
Once you get in the cage and it gets hooked behind you, it's very final and it's very definite.
Making her professional debut tonight, fighting out of the streets of Butte in Butte, Montana.
Even if I was scared or anything, like, we are here and we just got locked in this cage together.
The beauty, the beast, the Bon Bon Show.
It's you, me, and a ref, and something's gonna happen, you know? One of us is gonna win, one of us is gonna lose. That's just how it is. I'm Ariel Beck. I'm an amateur MMA fighter, and I've been fighting for 4 years now.
Yep.
I didn't know what to think about the MMA. I've seen a lot of two guys from the bars that are like, oh yeah, I'm an MMA fighter and I'm gonna beat you up. Hate that, hate it with passion. But then I started hanging out with Jesse, and he's my coach, my corner man, my cut man, my traveling partner, and my husband.
I wrestled in high school and then started training MMA.
He gets very emotional when I fight, just because it is his wife. You know, like, he is a professional fighter himself, so he knows what it is, and he is the same as me. He won't tap it, you know, if he doesn't have to. Like, he'll have the ref stop it before anything.
Let's get that jab going.
It really brings you down a notch. You know, it's a very humbling, we'll put a humbling thing to tap. You know, it's completely against me to tap, and I will go through everything and all the pain and all the punches in the world before I'll tap. Like, I don't like to and I don't want to. Amateur, your record doesn't matter. You know, winning's nice, but it doesn't mean a lot. But when you're pro, it's more of a big deal. The girl that I was going to fight, Emily, she was really good on the ground. She was a really good grappler. She knew what she was doing on the ground. You know, like, she was not going to be an easy fight by any means. The cage is already set up. You know, the chairs are around it. People are starting to get things put together. Like, the fight is starting to form. Like, the crowd's great. So they just got me super pumped, you know. Like, these people are all here for me. We get ready to go, and she gets called out first, and she has her walkout song. And I think to myself, I have fought a girl before that came out to this song, and I lost. Oh, no, like, what's the chance that she's gonna have that song? Like, I have bad luck with this song. So, of course, that's not what I should have been thinking at that point. But then my song starts up.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
I have a huge smirk on my face, even when trying to be serious and fight. I just decided that I can't do the serious face, so I shouldn't try. And just smirk it out and get up there. So I get to the cage. They pat me down, put the Vaseline on my face, on the eyebrows and everything to, you know, like evade punches. And make sure my mouth guard's in and tell me good luck. And I get in the cage. Bell rings. They said go. I get right in her face and punch her, you know, and like push her back. Her being a smart grappler like she is, like felt the punches, didn't like them, so she shot on me, trying to take me down. So she went in for like a double leg takedown, you know, like went around my legs. She took me down and it was kind of a scramble. She was trying to get her hooks in. She was trying to get her ankles like right on my haunches, right on my hips, and then stretch me out.
Stand up, Ariel!
I don't know how she did it, but she snuck that arm in there, so sneaky. And I mean, just got it in really, really tight, you know, right against my neck to where I couldn't do much. Like I did a little hand fighting, but she had it in there so tight.
Hand fight, hips up. Ariel, she's hot. Get your hips up and head hot.
I am not one to tap. I hate to tap. I will not tap as long as I can.
Hand fight. Hand fight, Ariel, don't just lay there. Hand fight.
It was either tap or nap by that point. You know, starting to kind of gargle a little bit. So that's when I tapped.
It's first time I've tapped. I'm not good at losing. I wasn't supposed to go over her head like I did when she went to take me down. And it was to the point where I'm starting to gurgle a little bit. I didn't do what I was supposed to do.
My name's up.
You didn't. You just had a fight and she caught it.
You didn't do very good. It happens.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't do what you told me to do. I hurt you. I tried. I couldn't keep my hips up.
Didn't look like you were hand fighting.
She had me pinned down.
It looked like you tried to get out.
I was hand fighting. I hadn't talked for a long time.
You gotta get up there and grab her hands and pull them down. Don't tell me you were hand fighting when I seen you laying there like this. That's not hand fighting.
Nothing we can do about it now, but try to better work on it on me. I'm the next one. You know? Live and learn.
Just packing everything up once you've lost, it's like it doesn't even matter. Just shove it all in your bag. You know, fix all my losing stuff when I get home. And then it's like, you know, again, and just thinking, like, I'm not going to need this for a while because, like, I'm not going to be fighting for a little bit. It's a very definite ending, you know, like just putting it all in your bag in that cement locker room. You know, like that sucks, but now we have to go on to our next thing. We said our goodbyes and went to the truck and got in the truck. And we had everything packed up, heading for Helena. And it was, I mean, it's dark, it's the middle of the night. It's just us two driving. We've got our truck. It's not a matter of if you lose, it's a matter of when you lose. And everyone that has fought, you know, gets that and gets that humbling experience. I know that I have so much potential and so much to work on with my MMA. I know that I can go places with this. I will come back stronger than ever. I have the drive. I love the sport. I love everything about it. And I love to win.
Won't Tap Out was produced by Nate Hedgie. Supervising producer for Unfictional was Nick White. I'm Bob Carlson, and you're listening to Unfictional. Today on the program, Cut Your Losses, three stories about falling short and having to move on anyway. Next is a story from writer and storyteller Jessica Lee Williamson. That time she performed in her elementary school talent show, it did not go as planned. So the next year, she was determined that things would be different. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
There's a song called Maybe at the beginning of the movie Annie, where Annie wonders about the parents who dumped her off at that godforsaken orphanage. Maybe far away, or maybe they're real nearby. He may be pouring her coffee, she may be straightening his tie. Annie ends it on a hopeful note, saying that maybe they'll be there waiting for her and loving her when she wakes up. But they're not. Which makes it even more sad and depressing. Which is exactly the kind of material I've always been really attracted to as an artist. When I was in the third grade, I decided to sing Maybe for the school talent show. And the moment I stepped onto the stage, I found myself pondering some maybes of my own. Maybe I should have put some thought into it before I volunteered to sing alone in front of hundreds of people. And maybe I should have bothered to memorize the words to the song that I volunteered to sing alone in front of hundreds of people. I'd seen the movie Annie a handful of times over the course of my entire life and somehow figured that would be enough. So I only focused on the important questions, like should I wear a curly wig or will my short, newly permed hairdo suffice? The only thing I practiced was the ladylike curtsy I'd give at the end of my show-stopping routine. Next thing I knew, there I was, thinking, maybe standing on stage and crying isn't the best way to make my debut as a performer. Occasionally, I'd brace myself and take a deep breath, sending out these tiny ripples of hope that I might just pull it together. But I never did. I just stood there and cried for 2.5 minutes while the audience watched in a horrified silence. My mother did not want that moment to scar me for life, so she encouraged me to learn from my mistakes and to try again, a whole lot harder, next year. She also suggested I do something different, because revisiting the act might make the audience uncomfortable. It was my idea to find a co-star so I wouldn't have to go it alone. I found that co-star in the pages of a JCPenney Christmas catalog. He was an Oliver Hardy ventriloquist doll. The catalog description said that he was famous and loved by audiences around the world. I wanted to be loved by audiences too, so I put his item number at the top of my Christmas list and patiently awaited the arrival of the doll that I was certain would change my life. He came with a 2-page Xerox copied pamphlet titled, How to Be a Ventriloquist. It offered vague suggestions like, do try not to move your lips, and don't forget to smile. I spent the next 4 months practicing tongue twisters in the mirror and reading every joke book I could find. By the end of it, I had a 3-minute act originally titled The Jessica and Hardy Show. It was a combination of joke telling and banter, peppered with the occasional zinger. We opened with some knock-knocks, then philosophized over who had it worse, a giraffe with a sore throat or a centipede with a broken leg. At some point I'd say, Hardy, sometimes I think you're dumber than a log. He'd respond with, watch it, you know, my mother was a log. We'd wrap it all up with a heartfelt moment. I'd say, I love you, Hardy. He'd say, I love you too. And then, after a comedic beat, he'd add, but you still drive me nuts. By the day the talent show arrived, I felt confident and even a little excited about my act. They implemented a full dress rehearsal that year, due in large part to the live train wreck I personally put on the year before. For that rehearsal, my mother painted my face like a happy clown. But for the real show, either because that's how I roll, or because the universe was foreshadowing what would happen next, I asked her to paint my face like a sad clown instead. In the act before mine, two girls did a comedy routine. It fell flat during rehearsal, but was a smash hit during the actual show because they stole almost all of my jokes. As I listened to the audience laugh at those two girls, my heart broke and I started to panic. That's when my mother leaned over and told me that it didn't matter if they took my jokes, because I was a ventriloquist, which was considered an art form, and that made it totally different. When she said that to me, I really felt like an artist. And even though he wasn't real, Oliver Hardy was the person who brought that out of me in the first place. So the talent show MC called my name. I went to grab my co-star. But sometimes good things come to an end. Just moments before we were to step out onto stage, Oliver Hardy, the doll, met his end at the hands of Jimmy Moore, a known troublemaker with a permanent orange tang stain on his upper lip. I guess Jimmy saw my doll sitting on my seat and wondered what it would feel like to rip the mouth out of something that somebody loved. The MC called my name again. I was 9 years old, and the phrase, "screw it, I'm not going to do that," didn't occur to me at that age. So I walked up on stage alone, and I cried, just like I did the year before. The only difference was that this time, I had a sad clown face to accompany my curly wig. I guess that was an unexpected bonus. If you could put a question mark at the end of a clap, I'd say that's what the applause sounded like. Just a slow, rhythmic slapping sound that begged the question, what was that? What it was me wondering if maybe there was something that felt worse than humiliating myself in front of hundreds of people all because I was ill-prepared. Maybe it felt worse to do everything right, to practice and try my hardest and plan everything out perfectly so. It was doing everything right that created the most hope for love from audiences around the world, which made everything going wrong even more sad and depressing. But thankfully, that's exactly the kind of material I've always been really attracted to as an artist.
Jessica Lee Williamson is a writer, an artist, and a storyteller living in Los Angeles. She's a Moth Grand Slam winner, and she's been featured on the Moth podcast. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional, and today on the program, Cut Your Losses. And we close with a story from producer David Weinberg. He has a dream, and it's a simple dream, but making it happen just keeps getting more and more complicated. From KCRW.com, this is Unfictional.
I wish I could tell you that I had thought this through better, but I didn't. I remember in the ad for the RV, it said, "You can drive this thing anywhere." That's what it said. At the time I was working at Applebee's, my life had sort of bottomed out. I was living in my parents' basement. I came up with a plan. I thought, well, if I go to Alaska and I go out into the wilderness and I run out of money, then I can just start my life over. And I would come home every night from work and just look at RVs on eBay and fantasize about getting out of Colorado and going to Alaska in style. But there was hardly anything that I could afford. The idea was that we would get something big enough that me and my three friends could all live in it when we got up there. And then all of a sudden, this RV pops up on eBay. Basically a Dodge van with the back part of it cut off and then like an RV put on top of it. It was perfect. It had everything. It had a full standing shower, kitchen, bathroom, two beds, table. This thing is awesome. And it's only $995, you know. This is the one that's going to take us to Alaska. So I took the Greyhound up to Idaho to go pick up the RV. The plan was I was going to get the RV, drive it back to Colorado, all my friends would get in it, and then we would drive to Alaska. When I got there, I saw the RV, and it looked just like it did in the pictures. This old vintage RV, round headlights that look like eyes. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then I opened the door, like I walked into the RV. And then that was like the first moment where I was like, oh, you know, this is not a dream machine. Shag carpeting, wood panel walls. And it just felt like a place where dreams go to die. But at the same time, you know, I just saw the potential in it. I get in it, sit down, adjust the mirrors, put my seatbelt on, and I turn the ignition. And nothing happens. Silence. It turned out that whoever owned it before had rigged up a button that you had to push that was separate from the ignition. So I pushed it, and then it started. I remember pulling out of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and you go up this hill, and below you is a gorgeous valley with a lake, and I was just, like, exhilarating. I was like, I'm going to Alaska! It was just an amazing feeling. And then it was dark. I don't know what time it was, but it was dark. And I was in Montana, just driving, and all of a sudden, I just felt this, like, loud thud sound. And then just kind of sat there for a minute. This is not good. Tow truck comes, and he's like, there's a mechanic in Deer Lodge, Montana. So I was like, all right, take me to Deer Lodge. So the next morning, I wake up in the RV in the mechanic's lot in Deer Lodge, Montana. And the door to the mechanic shop is open. And I can just see this guy bent over the hood of a car. And he looks up, and he had kind of like a Moe haircut from the Three Stooges, like a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And he had a hair lip. I said, excuse me, my RV broke down, and I'm wondering if you could fix it. And popped the hood. It did not take him long. If you blew a rod, your engine is completely shot. I wouldn't bother fixing this thing. You basically have to put a new engine in it, and it's not worth it. So I ended up leaving the RV with the mechanic. He said he would hold on to it, and I hitchhiked back to Colorado, basically just to buy myself time because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'd already invested all my savings in the RV, and I didn't want to just get rid of it. I ended up finding an engine for pretty cheap and had it shipped back up to Montana with instructions for the mechanic, his name is Bill, to just put the engine in, and I would pay for it. And he said no problem. He said he could do it in 3 weeks. So I figured, great, only 3 more weeks of Applebee's, and then I'll be on my way. So 3 weeks go by. I call Bill. He says everything's going as planned. Come on up. And so me and my friends leave Colorado and head up to Deer Lodge to pick up the RV. And we get there. I see the RV, and the hood's open, and there's a gaping hole where the engine is supposed to be. And so I see this, and I'm like, what the f*** is going on? Like, this engine is supposed to be in the RV. We're going to Alaska in this thing, and the engine isn't in it. And he's like, oh, no, we got all the wiring harnesses, we got all the things, it's all lined up. All we got to do is put the engine in and then hook up the wires. And I was like, do you think you'll be finished today? And they're like, no, probably won't be finished today. I was like, okay. I was like, do you think you'll be finished tomorrow? Do you have an idea? And they're like, oh, just a couple days. I think like a couple days. We should have this thing like ready to go in a couple days. I have to live in the RV now with my friends, hoping it's like one night. We stay the night. Tomorrow, by the end of the day, he puts the engine in. And Bill had a sidekick named Terry. This like big fat guy with like a shirt that didn't go all the way over his belly button. And just like a slob of a man. And pretty quickly, I started to realize that Bill was kind of incompetent. And I started thinking, we might have to live with Bill and Terry for a long time. So then, you know, we crawl into the RV. We go to sleep, and I sleep up on the bed above the cabin. So you can look down, and you can see where the engine is supposed to be. And I remember waking up that first morning, and I could hear that they had started working on the engine. And so I reach my head over, they can't see me, and it's like I just see the back of Terry and Bill's heads putzing around in there. And then I notice that on Terry's hand is this ring, this like big ring, and I look at it, and it's a ring with a big swastika on it. Now what? Like, I've never met a real life Nazi ever. And I have a Jewish last name, it's Weinberg. It's pretty obviously Jewish, but he didn't know that at the time. I had never given him my full name, thankfully. I was really terrified. I was like, if these guys find out that I'm Jewish, what are we gonna do? Is it gonna be a problem? Are they gonna fight us? Are they gonna take my RV? I owed him $1,800. I just felt like no good could come of this. You know what I mean? And so the second day goes by really slowly, and they're like tinkering with this thing, but not a lot's getting done. And it's really awkward and weird. And basically, we just try to stay out of their way. Day three, the engine's in there, it's running. Let's get out of here. So I have to go pay him, and so I step into his office. It's like this dingy office, linoleum floor, three chairs by the door. And Terry's sitting in one of the chairs. Just me and those two in the office. And I'm like standing at the counter paying. And he's like, I need to make out the receipt, the bill of sale. I remember him being like, I need to see your driver's license. I was like, all right. So I pull my driver's license out and I set it down and I watch him. He's like filling out the thing and he's like stops writing and he looks up at me. And he goes, Weinberg? And I was like, yep. And then he just looked at me. And then he looked over at Terry. Terry looked at him, and then they both looked at me. And it was just, like, silent for a moment. And he's like, what are you, related to a lawyer or something? I was like, And then threw the $1,800 on the counter, grabbed my license, very quickly jumped out of the office. And I was like, guys, let's go right now. And so jumped in the RV, pulled out, and I just felt this huge sense of relief. About 50 miles down the road, the RV just started filling up with gas fumes. And then it wouldn't run. It just like stopped working. And so we pulled over. And I just decided I didn't ever want to see Bill again. I didn't think there was anything good that was going to come out of going back to there. These guys, like, ripped us off, you know? Like, I just spent $1,800 for this, and, like, I got nothing. Part of me was just afraid. Like, I think I just felt like I had gotten out, you know? So we got the RV fixed enough to get us to Seattle, but by Seattle we realized there was no way that thing was going to make it to Alaska. So I ended up leaving it under a bridge, and we drove to Alaska in my friend's car instead, three bikes piled on the trunk. Not quite in style as I'd hoped, but my friend would check on the RV and give me updates while I was living in Alaska, and he told me that the last time he checked on it, there was a bunch of homeless people almost circling it, like maybe they knew it was abandoned and they were hoping to live in it. New dreams in the making.
That's a story by David Weinberg. He's a producer here at KCRW. It was produced along with Nick White. And once again, I should remind you that KCRW's annual 24-hour radio race is coming up. This time, it's going to run between Saturday, August 6th, and Sunday, August 7th. And the way this works is you form a team or you work alone and you register for the race. And then right when the race starts, you'll be given a theme. And you need to put together a well-made, compelling radio story with sound and narration and all that stuff in one mad dash 24-hour period. We'll have a link to more information about the radio race at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. Podcast the show on iTunes. Follow the show on Twitter at Unfictional or like us on Facebook. But most importantly, I hope you'll tell your friends about the show and you'll join me next time for Unfictional from kcrw.com.